new developments in the House of Tomorrow, which, of course, is one of the four famous homes that came from the Chicago 1933 World's Fair over to Indiana once the World's Fair was completed. It's been, of course, one of the Century of Progress homes that's been on display often, at least once or twice a year, at least, for the tours have been set up by Indiana Landmarks. But now there's an interesting offer that is being made for some work that could be maybe possibly considered as restoration work. And to find out more about this, we have Todd Zeiger. He's the director of the Northern Regional Office of Indiana Landmarks with us. He's based out of South Bend, and the National Park, of course, the Indiana Dunes National Park, as it's now known, is part of the Indiana Landmarks territory. Todd, as always, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Good afternoon. Hey, thanks for ringing me in, and glad to join you.
Well, this is an interesting development. For hardly anybody, I think, would not know what these houses that have been known for decades as the Century of Progress homes are all about. But this one in particular is certainly of interest because it's one of the more famous ones, I suppose. For those who are not familiar with what the five Century of Progress homes are, tell us about them and how they ended up over here in Northwest Indiana after the Chicago World's Fair closed in 1933. Or 34, I should say. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, closing in 1934. They're a collection of homes that are in the Indiana Dunes National Park that were moved there after the close of the fair by Robert Bartlett. And he was using them much like they were at the fair to kind of entice people to come over and visit what he was developing at that time, which is called Beverly Shores. That town still exists. And he brought them over as a seed to start his little development over there, and would bring folks over, show them the houses, and then, you know, I would anticipate a little sales pitch to buy some land and build a nice cottage over there in Beverly Shores. And that was very successful. He sold out that development, and then these houses were eventually sold into private hands, lived in for many decades. The National Park began buying properties to create the Indiana Dunes National Park, now known, then the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, and over time acquired them, but really didn't have the money to restore them, didn't have a use for them, and so they just sat kind of there along the lake. Many people, you know, would remember driving by them and kind of wondering about their story. And so over the past 20 years or so, we've worked with the park to increase awareness of it. And then this leasing program that has saved four of the five houses through a partnership between us, the National Park, and the private folks. And that's where the House of Tomorrow comes back around.
For folks that are not familiar with the House of Tomorrow, although I don't hardly know how you could not be familiar with it, all you need is one look at the picture, and you can tell it's certainly a House of Tomorrow. And that was the idea, when it was designed, was to be something that would be amenable to the future, and that is what it's all about. You can describe the House of Tomorrow, what it looks like, at least to our radio audience.
The House of Tomorrow was a duodecagon, a 12-sided structure. It was designed by George Fred Keck, and it was very futuristic. Floor-to-ceiling glass windows on the upper level, kind of an open floor plan. Just keep in mind, you know, people were living in bungalows or maybe an old, what we call a Queen Anne at the time, so small rooms maybe, you know, divided up. Glass ceilings or glass walls certainly weren't common. And so Keck designed this futuristic, almost round building. Included opening garage doors with electric eyes. It included the dishwasher and modern equipment. It included an airplane hangar, which everybody's always fascinated by. You could park your airplane in. And, you know, just very futuristic, very much pushing the envelope of the time of what a house might look like in 100 years. And that was really the charge in that home and industrial arts group that this house sat within with these other Century of Progress homes was, you know, how would we be living in the future? Different types of technologies, and this house definitely pushed the envelope with that regard.
We should note that George Fred Keck, the architect who designed this particular house, was really well ahead of his time because it was a number of years ahead of what turned out to be more famous houses, I suppose, in a way, too. Of course, you get to see some of architect Mies van der Rohe's work when you go to downtown Chicago, the original one of the two 1 Illinois Center buildings is designed by van der Rohe. Philip Johnson, of course, created a glass house of his own, too, which is, I guess, still standing. But this House of Tomorrow is one that you get to see, I suppose, a little closer than maybe some of these others. But it has its own, as you mentioned, some of the rather innovative ideas toward the future that make this house certainly well worth keeping around. Tell us what condition the House of Tomorrow is in now.
Right. Folks drive by it and they're kind of surprised. We have it wrapped with some temporary wrapping and walls. It lost its original glass windows back in 1935 when it was first moved over. And so what Keck visioned in his design was lost pretty early after it was moved. But that's really the importance of the house, is kind of Keck's design. You get back onto the inside, though, it still has its original kitchen. The baseboards are there, some of the Carrara glass. There's quite a bit of original integrity still in the house and available for restoration. And that's part of this effort, is to restore this house, kind of bring back the best of what was there in Keck's vision. But what's really exciting, we think, is finding someone who wants to join with us and layer in kind of the next level. What would be some features of a house of tomorrow in the future? Kind of taking it to the next step. What sorts of high technology can we put into this property to help it operate? So we're really looking to balance the best of Keck's design, those windows and some of those innovative features, but balance it with sort of a new house of tomorrow with modern technology, and balancing that. That's the vision for this project.
Now tell us, if we will, a little more about this proposed 50-year lease that Indiana Landmarks would like to do with some party who would take on this very very daunting task, I suppose, for some, of restoring this house.
In some ways, yes, but in other ways, no. I mean, others that have taken on these projects, they're the heroes, and you know, they look at it as a way to give back, to restore a property that really is a one-of-a-kind. That term gets used a lot, but there is no other house of tomorrow. And so this is an opportunity for someone who is inclined towards liking historic architecture, wanting to help us save this property, to do that and to step up. It's a large project, certainly not for the faint of heart. And, you know, that's going to be part of our criteria as we search for the right party, that they have the capacity to do the project, financially, certainly, but also just experience. This can't be the first-time restoration effort. And so it's a real combination of giving back, helping save something that's very unique that folks recognize, and being a part of that story moving forward in the future, and just being able then to enjoy that moving forward as a place to live.
Now, you can find out more here about this proposal that is being made on the Indiana Landmarks website. And you'll see pictures, of course, of what the House of Tomorrow looks like today, all wrapped up in house wrap, so to speak, and the condition it's in right now. So you can tell it's still in pretty good shape. Would you say that probably some of the more innovative points that was designed by Mr. Keck and was built into the house originally might be some of the things that we take for granted today, like garage door openers?
Absolutely. I think, you know, many of us are happy and, you know, thankful to have dishwashers in our houses. It was not the case then. You know, opening garage doors with electric eyes, a commonplace today in many places in some form. Just the open floor concept of how we live in today's world was not seen much then. And so, yeah, absolutely. Now, did everything come true? You know, absolutely not. That's what a World's Fair is about, is helping kind of set that dream out there. Some things come to fruition, some things don't. I'm still waiting on my airplane and airplane hangar for my house. I'm not sure about others, but, you know, it certainly, we can look back and think, wow, you know, this was fairly innovative. One other thing I would just point out about that is, you know, at the time in the early 30s, it was not common to have an indoor garage, to park your car inside the house. And this house was putting that out there, along with the other homes that are in the Century of Progress District. They have these sort of attached garages. So absolutely some things came to pass that we consider standard today. Some things didn't, that we look back on and think, well, what were they thinking? But that's just how World's Fairs worked.
Now, give us an idea of what some of the specifications that the Indiana Landmarks is asking for anybody who, or any organization, we should say, a nonprofit or otherwise, that's considering taking on this restoration, and in turn we get the long-term lease of the House of Tomorrow. What are they going to be asked to be able to do?
Well, the good news is we've spent the last couple years, and we first announced doing some work on the house a couple years ago. We spent the time making sure that our agreement with the Park Service was buttoned up. But more importantly, we engaged a really great team of architects and engineers to help us develop the restoration plans. And so what we can hand over to the successful party is ready designs that have been approved by the Park Service that will do what we talked about, and that is return the glass walls to the outside, you know, get a new exterior skin on that would replicate what it looked like in 1933, but yet layer in some new things on the inside, some additional bathrooms, some additional bedrooms in places that are not historically sensitive. And so, you know, we have the specifications, we have the approved plans, we've got a great team of designers on board that are willing and ready to work with the successful party, so we can really jumpstart this project from the beginning and set that kind of vision for the property. And that's really important, because we'd like to find someone who's ready to get started on this project pretty quickly, so that we don't go through another winter if possible, in its current state. So those are some things we're looking for and some expectations that we have.
Do you think it's possible that, like what happened in the case with the Philip Johnson house, that in his case, the man who designed it actually lived in it, do you think that maybe that you'll get whoever's working on the restoration work might be the occupant of the facility once it's all done?
Yeah, you know, we don't dismiss any opportunities that there be a good candidate out there. So, you know, the only requirement is that it is a single family home. It can't be a rental property or put out on Airbnb and that sort of use. That's really, really critical. This is for a single family use for the party that takes it on. And we're, you know, we would love to have connections with individuals that do the restoration or, you know, people that have a connection to this house. That'd be a great kind of ending chapter to this story.
Also, too, I suppose we should also note that the National Park Service will still, of course, have actually the actual ownership of the house, and that you're going to have to be sure that you can, whoever takes over then becomes an occupant, will have to get along with the fact that it's going to be on display at least a couple times a year, right?
That's correct.
That's where Indiana Landmarks comes into play here. So
yeah, we are a part of the project moving forward. We approve anything that goes on with the house construction-wise, inside and out, along with the Park Service. And then we do coordinate a tour that is very popular, and those tickets will go on sale in August, so stay tuned, that the house will be open moving forward. That's part of the requirement, that they're open once a year at least. And then we do ask on special occasions folks to work with us to open them up, but we try and respect their privacy as well. So it's a balancing act. It is owned by the national park. It's in the middle of a national park, so you're going to have people looking at the house, and so you have to be comfortable with that sort of thing as well moving forward.
Now, do you think that maybe the task of turning the what is now wrapped up house into a house with lots of glass windows might be something that somebody might have to think twice about if they want to live in there? You know, it's not the old phrase about people living in glass houses, of course, but I mean having all these people that might possibly come by as visitors, at least from the outside.
Yeah, and we don't say you can't put up blinds and curtains, and that's part of the restoration program is to provide some privacy. And there's ways to limit the public coming up onto the property, and we work with all the lessees on that. So, but certainly we need folks that are comfortable that they are in a national park, and there are going to be people stopping on the street looking up at the house. That's part of why we want to do this, is preserve these houses so people can enjoy them. Really, is almost public art in some respects, and then we have tours on occasion that open up the interior. So it is certainly different than just living out in the country by yourself.
Have you got any reaction from the folks at the Indiana Dunes National Park about this proposal to in turn get the restoration of the House of Tomorrow together in exchange for the long-term lease?
This would not be possible without their strong partnership, and they've been a part of this conversation ongoing for years. So they're quite pleased. They see it as a way, as has been from the beginning, a way to preserve this house, you know, bring money to the table that otherwise they don't have, and a use. They don't have a use for these properties. And so they get the public benefit of restoring the properties for the public to see. And that's really a benefit, additional tourism. I can tell you, I'm rarely out there at the site. In even the worst weather, people aren't stopped and just looking at these houses. It's a real attraction. And we think getting this one finished up is the final piece in this project is really important.
Well, how fitting to be able to have this House of Tomorrow all set up for restoration, and in turn the restoration work underway, and have it completed and occupied in time for the National Lakeshore to become officially the 61st national park in the country.
Yeah, it's a good start to kind of wrap this piece up, and we're so excited for their change of name and a new brand for them, and we're just pleased to be a part of that story as they move forward, absolutely.
Well, now we have to ask if anybody is interested in finding out more about what this proposal is for doing the restoration work in exchange for the long-term lease for the House of Tomorrow. They actually like to see more information about what you're asking for in the specifications. Where can they find this information?
We have a page up at indianalandmarks.org/House of Tomorrow. So that's our webpage, indianalandmarks.org/House of Tomorrow. There's a frequently asked questions page there. And then there's also a page where you can fill out a very simple form, name, address, etc., that expresses your interest, and we'll get back to you and have a conversation.
Well, Todd, thank you very much for going through the details about what is being proposed by Indiana Landmarks and the National Park Service, and trying to continue the trend of showing off these great Century of Progress homes and getting them in the restoration process. Get this final one, the House of Tomorrow, all fixed up and ready for an occupant sometimes in the future. Thanks for being with us today to talk about it.
Thank you for inviting me, and you all have a great day.
Oh, you too. Todd Zeiker is the Northern Indiana Director for Indiana Landmarks. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and today our guest is Mr. David Schatz. He's the Director for Policy for ChargePoint. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carl. Good to be here.
So, Dave, tell us, what is ChargePoint and what do you do?
ChargePoint's the largest network of electric vehicle charging stations in the nation. We have over 57,000 charging spots in our network nationwide. And I'm Director for Public Policy, so I work with legislators and regulators across the country to see how we can scale EVs in every single market.
We hear a lot about electric vehicles, but are people really buying them?
And you're right. We do get a lot of attention. The electric vehicle market does get a lot of attention, but I think it's warranted. The numbers show that there's significant and sustained growth in this sector. And nationally, sales are double what they were just 3 years ago. There have been nearly 1 million EVs sold to date nationwide, and that's an incredible number when you consider that 10 years ago, there were relatively few models that were even available on the market.
No, so that is so correct. So why are people making the decision to go to electric, David?
For most folks, it's simple dollars and cents. EVs are cheaper to fill up than gas cars. They cost less to maintain. And most importantly, new models are getting cheaper to buy. The increase in sales is due in large part to the growing number of actual models for consumers to choose from. And nearly every single automaker has plans to introduce new electric models or to electrify their current fleet. So whether it's a sports car, a sedan, or a minivan, dealer lots will be able to offer and meet the needs of a lot of a variety of samples.
So how many charging stations are there nationwide, and how many are there in Indiana?
There are about 50,000 public charging spots available across the country. And in Indiana, there are about 300 public charging spots. There are many more private charging stations that are located either behind a fence or for private use for workplaces. And those numbers are typically not reported since they're not available to all drivers.
Sure. So I know it's the chicken and the egg question. So do we have enough charging infrastructure out there for drivers to make the switch to electric, David?
The short answer is no. We don't have enough charging to meet the needs of today's drivers, let alone prepare for the growth that we're going to see in years to come. We often hear about that chicken and egg problem. What will come first, the cars or the charging, and what will drive the market forward? I think it's not really chicken and egg. We need to look at the whole meal. We have to be able to do both at the same time.
So you're listening to Green Fleet Radio. Today's edition is with Mr. David Schatz. He's the Director for Policy for ChargePoint. So, David, I know that there are some myths associated with charging impact on the grid. So this is a question I think you probably hear daily. So can you address some of those issues?
Yeah. I've talked to a number of utilities, and many tell me that the impacts will be minimal. And, in fact, charging is actually a really important opportunity for utilities. Charging might allow us to use more of the grid's capacity, something that all of us pay for, especially at times that are most beneficial to the grid. Think about charging that takes place at home, typically overnight, at a time when most folks aren't using that much power. That charging can help us to utilize the grid at strategic times. And since charging stations can be made to collect data on every single charging session, that's what ChargePoint does. It can be smart charging can help to inform grid managers of charging activities, where they are taking place, for how long, how much power is needed. So smart charging can really be a benefit to grids.
I see. So is there anything that states can do to encourage more build out of electric vehicle infrastructure?
Absolutely. First, we have to make sure that our regulations recognize EV charging and enable all possible business models for operating charging stations in Indiana. Next, the government can help bring together stakeholders in this space to talk about, just like we're doing today, how best to achieve the build-out we really need. And finally, we need to take full advantage of the funding coming down the pike. Funds stemming from the Volkswagen Dieselgate settlement can be used for EV charging infrastructure, and the state is now deciding how to best use those funds. We think that a rebate or a grant program that's open and competitive would result in hundreds of charging stations built throughout Indiana.
So as we come to the end of our program, what is one myth that you would like to answer for our listeners about electric charging stations?
The myth that they're for only the richest folks out there. I think that's totally a myth. The price of electric vehicles is coming down. More models are coming to market. And I think within the next couple of years, every single person in the market will be able to purchase an EV. And I know that some models available on today's market are actually cheaper than the average cost of an internal combustion vehicle. So it is totally a myth that this is all for the wealthiest among us. This is for everyday folks, and I'm looking forward to seeing the growth in Indiana.
So how can our listeners learn more about ChargePoint?
You can visit our website at www.chargepoint.com.
Well, David, thank you. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to David Schatz. He's the Director for Policy for ChargePoint. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. Carl Lissick talking with David Schatz with the ChargePoint. You can hear this conversation every Wednesday at this time on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are also available online on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. The National Alliance for Mental Illness says about 2 million people with mental illnesses are booked into jails across the country every year. But most counties just aren't able to handle the people while they're in custody. And in her second of the two-part series on jail overcrowding, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier says the problem's an especially big one here in Indiana, where about half of the county jails are overcrowded.
The small Faith Lutheran Church in Madison, Indiana, serves as a sanctuary to families in more than one way. The community room inside is filled with several long tables and chairs. Once a week, parents, spouses, siblings, and children gather here for the National Alliance for Mental Illness's family-to-family classes. Pastor Jeff Flug helps lead them.
We get into how to communicate better with your loved one, learning resources.
The classes are how Flug and Rodney Sellers met. They both have family members with mental illnesses and say trying to help them is a challenge. Sellers says his wife is bipolar and he often has to call for help.
Most of the time, I've had police come and they seem to, have no idea what they're dealing with.
He says officers rarely know what questions to ask or how to respond. Flug says he's had similar experiences, and he considers himself lucky. In one case, his son resisted arrest, but police didn't take him to jail.
But instead, they took him to the hospital.
But that's not the case for many Hoosiers suffering from mental illnesses. Vandenberg County Sheriff Dave Wedding says an increasing number of them are ending up in county jails.
And I've had judges tell me, Sheriff, I have to ask you to hold this person because we don't know what to do with them.
It's a tough spot for counties to be in because many of their jails are already overcrowded. While Vandenberg County has a medical wing where it can house some inmates with mental illnesses, Wedding says the resources are limited.
You need personnel and you need capital to fix the problem.
The problem is even more urgent at smaller jails like in Hancock County. On this particular day, three women who are on suicide watch are housed in a padded cell built for just one. Jail commander Keith Oliver says they don't have anywhere else to put them.
You have a male and a female both suicidal at the same time. What do? You pick the one that's you really believe.
Oliver says building a new jail where there's space for more inmates would help. Plans for a new facility include a therapeutic and medical wing.
The mental illness is a serious thing that we're going to see for a long time coming, and we have to find ways to adapt to that.
Multiple studies show the rate of serious mental illness among incarcerated populations is 3 to 5 times higher than the general population. But some advocates question whether building bigger jails is the best solution. Jasmine Heiss is director of outreach and public affairs strategist for the Vera Institute's In Our Backyards initiative. She says counties that are considering building new jails are often devoid of other services.
Your jail becomes the only answer. And then when you continue to invest in newer and bigger jails, then that just reaffirms that jail is the only hammer when you have any number of nails or any number of problems you're trying to solve.
Sellers and Pflug say that's not how it should be. They'd like the state to take a comprehensive look at ways to improve mental health resources, and not just in jails.
Law enforcement, God bless them, their hands are tied. They're not equipped for this. So it belongs in the hands of the state legislature and our mental health communities.
But he acknowledges there's no easy solution. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. And people from around the Indiana met at the State House yesterday to press lawmakers to raise the cigarette tax. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports that the rally focused on the health benefits of such a measure.
The Raise It for Health Coalition members point out that smoking is directly related to many of Indiana's poor health rankings, like cancer and infant mortality rates. Indiana University School of Medicine's Dr. Ryan Nguyen says the proposed $2 tax hike is a proven public health move.
When I talk to patients nowadays who have quit smoking and I ask them, what motivated you to quit? The number one reason that I hear is that cigarettes just got too expensive.
Nyla Jackson, a teenager from Elkhart County, helped fill out cards urging lawmakers to support the tax increase.
It's important to be here because I'm trying to save my generation from smoking.
Indiana hasn't raised the cigarette tax in over a decade. The move could generate an estimated $350 million annually for public health funding. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
A bill to fund optional firearm training for teachers passed the Indiana House yesterday. Republican Representative Jim Lucas wrote the bill to create a specialized 40-hour training program and to use state funds to pay for it.
But simply what House Bill 1253 does, it just provides another tool in a toolbox in fighting the horrible issue and the possibility of a school shooting. It does not take away from the need to do other things.
Some lawmakers who oppose the bill say that they're concerned that the training isn't enough, and some argue that more guns would make schools less safe. Indiana schools already have the authority to arm teachers. The measure passed with a 72-25 vote, and it now moves on to the Indiana Senate. Speaking of the General Assembly, with the number of bills moving through both the House and the Senate these days, it's time to focus in on a few of those in particular that deal with the environment. And with us with some updates on what the General Assembly is doing in these important policy ideas, we have Jesse Carbonta. He's the Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council with us today. Jesse, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Hello, Chris. Hope it's good to be with you.
Well, thank you for joining us. We know that some of the important environmental policy that is still very much alive before the General Assembly is now in the second half of the session. And I guess let's kind of go down the list here that I know of the ones that are ones involving the environment. There's one that I guess it even got some attention nationally because the Supreme Court of the United States came out with a decision not to take up a case that came out of the Indiana Supreme Court. And that in turn is involving one measure that is now, I guess, being reviewed. A bill that actually it was written up by State Senator Karen Talion of Northwest Indiana. Tell us what this Senate Bill 553 is all about and why the Hoosier Environmental Council is keeping a very close eye on it.
Sure. Well, we want to give top credit really to Save the Dunes, which has led the effort to advance SB 553. But the essence of the bill, the bill is very much tied to the court ruling you mentioned, where the Indiana Supreme Court really ruled in favor of the public over private property owners with respect to defining the lakeshore as publicly owned and accessible. And what SB 553 is, it supplements that decision by spelling out what exactly is a permissible recreational use of the beach along the lakeshore. And it basically says that the public have the right to fish, to boat, to swim, to walk, to run, to picnic, to sunbathe, etc. And it's something that we certainly hope that enough senators vote on so that this passes through the Senate.
I know, as you mentioned, it's very, very definitive, I guess, as to what you can actually do along the lakeshore. Maybe it seems rather like it's common sense, but you have to sometimes spell these things out, don't you?
That's right. And the court actually explicitly called on the General Assembly to spell out what those permissible recreational uses are.
Do you get the impression that they just didn't want to take any chances, I suppose? They're not going to get every single possible use down, but they want to be sure to have as many as possible, I suppose.
Exactly. I think it's really for the benefit of the public, such that there's no ambiguity as to what they can do and not do on the beaches.
What kind of a reaction have you all had in looking over the information when it came out here, what the U.S. Supreme Court had to say in deciding not to take up the Indiana Supreme Court case?
Oh, well, this has been, we've been monitoring about 70 different bills, Chris, this session. So all we can say about the Supreme Court ruling is we're glad that they basically deferred to the Indiana Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. One of the other measures that involves the environment that I know that you're looking closely at the Hoosier Environmental Council isn't, I guess, specifically involving the environment, but there's a relationship to it. Senate Bill 105 is one that takes up the issue of a redistricting reform. How does the HEC feel about this and their involvement in wanting to keep a close eye on it?
Yes, and Chris, we've been very invested in redistricting reform because we very much believe that the outcomes we're seeing in the environment are very much tied to the fact that our districts, our legislative districts, as well as our congressional districts, are very gerrymandered, and that's been the conclusion of a study by the University of Chicago. And there are two basic models for how we go about reforming districts. One is how they're drawn, and then the other question is who draws them. And we, along with a number of other organizations, have been backing the idea of a citizens-led redistricting commission. Unfortunately, bills in the Senate and in the House were not heard in terms of the citizen redistricting commission, even though similarly conservative states have done so. However, in good news, you've got SB 105, which is expected to have a floor vote today or possibly tomorrow, which would specify how the districts are drawn and basically stipulate certain criteria for how you draw these maps.
Well, so this one certainly is not dead to be sure that it still has lots of life left to it, I suppose, too. Renewable Energy Day is coming up on March 6th, according to the calendar. And I suppose this next bill we could talk about, it would be wonderful if the legislature happened to pass it and put it into, get ready, I guess, to send it on to the governor with the hopes of putting it into law. What is a pre-solar bill, I guess it's being referred to as, House Bill 1331.
That's right. Chris, this bill is a resurrection of an effort from last session that deals with the reality that there are a lot of homeowner associations that have kind of an outdated view of solar. They wrote covenants in such a way that it would prohibit solar altogether in their HOA or maybe not permit these solar panels from being on a roof, which is obviously the main place where people put solar panels. And what this bill does is it reduces those onerous regulation and replaces it with more common sense ones, such as you don't want to have a solar panel jutting from a roof. That could be a hazard to the public. Or you don't want solar panels projecting from the ground in such a way that it extends above the fence between you and an adjacent property owner. So we like this bill. We urge people to support it. That's, again, HB 1331. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, this bill passed late yesterday out of the House, and it's on the way to the Senate.
We're talking with Jesse Carbonda, who's the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, and among the many environmental policy measures that are up for review this time is, of course, some of these incorporated in what the state government budget's going to be for the next 2 years. That's what the lawmakers are looking at now. And one of these areas to keep an eye on the budget is for drinking water protections. And I guess in a way that there are concerns about enough money being set aside for that, I understand.
That's right. You know, there's been a nearly a one-third drop in total spending by the Indiana Department of Environmental Management since 2007 in terms of general appropriation funds for IDEM. And of course, that is in contrast to the fact that our economy and population have both grown since 2007. So it's going in the wrong direction. We should have a well-funded, well-staffed agency that deals with a growing economy. And there are so many different facets of what IDEM does that's important to the public, but we wanted to zero in on drinking water. And as you alluded to, there's this concern that there aren't enough staff to oversee the more than 4,000 public drinking water systems across Indiana. So we are advancing a proposal to boost funding by about $750,000 per year for IDIM, specifically for drinking water, to deal with the fact that there have been complaints that the inspectors are not experienced enough, that permits are not being approved fast enough, and we think this will really be to the ultimate benefit of the quality of our drinking water.
Now, we know right now, we only know about roughly what the governor wants to see in the budget and what the Indiana House GOP is offering up in its version of the budget. We haven't heard about anything from the Senate yet, I suppose. So do you think that even if there isn't something included in the House version, that something might be put in the Senate version?
That's right. You know, that there are certainly some senators who are on Senate appropriations that have been champions of water, such as Senator Ed Charbonneau of Valparaiso, and it's very much our hope that your listeners will contact him and ask him to support this IDAM proposal to boost funding for drinking water staff. We think that's very important. You know, another thing that's relevant, Chris, to Northwest Indiana is the Hoosier State Line. For the last couple of budget cycles, the state government has invested $3 million per year in the Hoosier State Line, which goes, again, from Indianapolis to Chicago and includes a stop in Dyer, and another $500,000 in funding that is kicked up by the communities that benefit from the Hoosier State Line. Unfortunately, that has been zeroed out, and we would certainly like to see that changed, and we certainly like money to be reinvested in Hoosier State when the budget bill goes over the Senate.
Yeah, I know that the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance, because the folks up here in Northwest Indiana are very, very positively affected by that, they'd like to at least make sure that there's something in the budget about that. That was one of the reasons why the Alliance was keeping a close eye on what the General Assembly is doing this session, because they want to be sure the funding was still there, to be sure. And Jesse, let's take up here as a final note some important investments in our wildlife refuges as well as habitats, parks and trails, everything, I guess, that pretty much comes under the Department of Natural Resources.
That's right, Chris. You know, we are alarmed by this real discrepancy between the size of the recreational sector for our state and the amount of money that our state government invests in our natural lands. The sector is $16 billion in size per year, and yet we have seen a 90% drop in general appropriations for the major state vehicle for protecting endangered prairies, endangered forests, endangered wetlands, which is the Indiana, what used to be known as the Indiana Natural Heritage Trust Fund, and it's now known as the President Benjamin Harrison Trust Fund.
Mm-hmm.
So we are calling for a dedicated, permanent source of funding for wilderness protection, which is very much to the benefit of Northwest Indiana and the state as a whole.
And there, if you'd like more information about the items that we've been talking about here, that the Hoosier Environmental Council is keeping a close eye on as far as the legislature is concerned, where can they find out more information?
It would be at hecweb.org/billwatch2019. And we try to keep that pretty frequently updated, and also folks who are on Facebook and Twitter, you can follow us there. And again, we tend to be pretty diligent in updating the public about how they can get involved.
Well, Jesse, thank you very much for the update. We do appreciate it, and we hope that we'll have a chance here either at the end of the session or before then to get back and talk about how some of these concerns are coming along, if they've made it through the General Assembly or have yet to be taken care of by the lawmakers. We appreciate you talking about today, though.
Thank you so much, Chris, and hope we can see folks from Northwest Indiana at Renewable Energy on March 6th, 2019, in the State House.
Jesse Carbonda is the Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. You're listening to Lakeshore Public Radio. The Indianapolis-based Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation is sending grants to school districts and to nonprofits all across the Hoosier State to help set up drug prevention programs and their educational opportunities in the fight against opioid addiction and overdoses. Claire Fidian Green is the president and CEO of the foundation, and she was talking with us about one grant in particular we're keeping an eye on that's going to Northwest Indiana. It's going to the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte County for their Partners in Prevention program for local schools.
We took a look at the landscape as we were learning about the opioid crisis and its impact on Indiana. And also, you mentioned our very high smoking rate. Indiana has one of the highest smoking rates in the country. And we took a look at what were the available resources coming from the state and other funders to help address these crises. And we saw the biggest emphasis was on helping people get into treatment who were struggling right now with an opioid use disorder or addiction. What we didn't see a lot of was prevention. And we thought the old adage certainly holds true that an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. So we decided to put together an initiative that we call Prevention Matters, and we identified the very best proven prevention programs that actually start as early as elementary school. And we launched, with the support of our board, a $12 million initiative over 3 years to help connect K-12 schools with proven substance use prevention programs, grades K through 12. Mm-hmm. So we have committed $11.9 million toward that initiative. And we believe very strongly that we should collaborate with everybody who's trying to tackle the opioid crisis and other substance use challenges around the state, including meth or whatever the challenge might be in a given community. So we have partnered with other foundations like the LaPorte County Foundation to help give them the tools that we've used in Marion County so that they can replicate Prevention Matters in their own community.
That's important, I think, to note that besides coming up with the grants to help school corporations and individual schools put together these K through 12 prevention programs, it's all showing that education is all basically the way that you help get the word out to not only start very young, but even to grown-ups as well, I imagine, to let them know that it's not wise to find yourself in the situation where you might become addictive to such drugs.
That's absolutely right, yes. And if you start as early as elementary school, what you're really doing is helping equip students with good decision-making skills so that when they're presented with an opportunity to try a drug or to experiment with alcohol, they might make a better choice. And in fact, the proven prevention programs that our initiative is supporting have proven just that they are effective at helping young people make not only good short-term decisions, but long-term decisions that help them avoid problems with addiction over the long term.
I know you've had a chance to look through a lot of the paperwork that comes about from the organizations that have asked to be involved in the prevention program, Partners in Prevention in particular, which is the one that the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte has established. Can you tell us a little bit about it and how it's gotten started and in turn has certainly gotten the attention of the Fairbanks Foundation to begin with?
Yes. Yeah, so as I mentioned, we believe very strongly in collaboration, and we convened a group of funders from all around the state, including the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte County, who are interested in trying to tackle the opioid crisis and other substance misuse challenges in their community. And so as we were developing Prevention Matters, we shared all of the information that we had developed and the research we'd done and tools, as well as the design of our Prevention Matters initiative. And the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte County, under the direction of Maria Fruth, the president and CEO, took the initiative to adapt that model for LaPorte County, and they call it Partners in Prevention. Mm-hmm. So I certainly would defer to her for more details about how they are going about doing that, but we have been very happy to come alongside them and provide information and resources to them as they launch that initiative serving schools in LaPorte County.
I would imagine that probably in each instance here, for each organization that has gotten financial assistance through the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation, that they all have their own certain little type of program, and certainly in this case that Partners in Prevention for LaPorte County is the same way too. But there have to be some common keys, I would imagine, between all of them and to be able to get the funding support and to become part of this this overall, I guess you could call it a network, I suppose, in a way of drug prevention programs. What are, if there are any particular points or keys that they all seem to have in common?
Yeah, so I think the very first is the willingness of the leadership of the school and the teachers and other staff in the school to provide this type of programming to students, and we've seen lots of enthusiasm from schools that are involved in prevention initiatives. And then we have a very select group of proven prevention programs that applicants were allowed to select from, and so we connected them with technical assistance providers who are experienced with implementing prevention programs in schools to help schools identify the program that best met the population needs of the students that they are serving and the community in which they're located. So So that was number one, is making sure it's actually a proven prevention program that has long-term evidence that it's effective at helping young people avoid substance misuse and eventually addiction. The second is these programs really are all about, at their essence, social and emotional well-being. It's equipping students with good decision-making tools so that will serve them well in all areas of their life, and certainly when it comes to making good decisions about drugs and alcohol. So those are key. And then the final thing is making sure that it's a cost-effective program, and all of the ones that we selected are cost-effective and can be sustained over the long term. Once they get up and running, the schools figure out how to incorporate the program into the regular school schedule and then train their staff so that it can be provided over the long term within their schools.
If there's any place that anyone can find more information about the overall Prevention Matters program, and perhaps, of course, they can, of course, find out more locally, in this case with LaPorte County, by getting in touch with the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte and individually, is there any place that the Prevention Matters program overall has information people can check out if they'd like to find out more, especially since they may be concerned about programs that might be set up in their school?
On our website, which is rm, as in Mary, ff, as in Frank, .org. /Prevention Matters. People can look for information on our website. And then I do encourage people in LaPorte to obviously take a look at the resources available at the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte and on their website.
That's Claire Fidian-Green with the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation. The assistance to the LaPorte Foundation is about $2 million over the next 4 years. There are 12 schools in LaPorte County, public, charter, and private, that are getting involved in this project. They're choosing their programs now, by the way, with the intention of being able to implement them sometime this fall. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for joining us. Tomorrow, it's Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, when we talk with some members of the Northwest Indiana media about the stories that they've posted online, as well as put in print in their respective publications. We will have, as well, too, something from Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson, along with reporters Meredith Colias-Pete, Greg Tejeda, and Carol Carlson from the Post-Tribune. We hope you can join us for that.